the reason I asked you about follow-up is that my presentation is about follow-up in a similar population. So tracking substance users in a low-income population, what does it take to achieve high response rates? That's the title of my talk. So are respondents with substance use problems harder to locate for follow-up in survey research? Well, by reputation, they are. When hard-to-reach populations are described in terms of their baseline characteristics, substance users are very often at the top of the list. However, the literature is really inconsistent on this, and in some studies they do show higher attrition rates, and others they do not. So we decided to look at whether or not they are in fact harder to reach for re-interview than other respondents using an empirical measure, and are they more likely to be lost to follow-up even using extended tracking efforts. The data source is the Welfare Client Longitudinal Study, or the WCLS. It's a survey of cash aid recipients in a county in Northern California. The county provides cash assistance via two programs. One is TANF, or Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, which is the federal welfare program for adults raising minor children, and a local general assistance program, which is a much more marginal program for childless adults, basically, who don't qualify for TANF. Respondents were first interviewed when they applied for aid. They came into the welfare and aid offices. They were sampled. They were interviewed at that time. And if they qualified for aid and received aid, they were then randomly sampled into the cohort study with an oversample of heavy drinkers and drug users so that there were enough respondents to do some meaningful analysis on that population. The WCLS used extensive follow-up procedures, which I'll describe in a minute. They were re-interviewed every year for 5 years and possibly longer than that. People who were located but refused to be interviewed were considered found for this study because we were actually looking at the process of finding them, not at their characteristics so much. And the respondents who had died in the interim were dropped from the analysis for that reason as well. So what do I mean by extensive follow-up efforts? The WCLS had a fieldwork agency that they contracted to do follow-up, and their scientific staff also did follow-up. And they hired a special tracker who was trained as a private investigator, and he was known as the secret weapon, Kenny the Secret Weapon. And he would stake out people's houses, he would stake out anywhere he thought they might be, he'd wait in his car for 5 hours, he did all kinds of private investigative things to find them. Needless to say, this is an unusual method of tracking respondents in any survey. There was file sharing among interviewers and staff, so everyone shared the files. Sometimes they worked on them at the same time. There was no limit on contact attempts. Tracking protocols were flexible. People could use their intuition. And as a result, some respondents got up to 12 letters, 57 phone calls, and 28 field visits before they were either found or the search period, that is the whole year, ended and they were starting on year 3. Respondents got cash incentives of $40 or $50 to continue in the study, depending on the circumstances. So I looked at response rates in the full sample and in subgroups of substance users with and without extended follow-up. Reviewed contact information provided by the full sample and by subgroups. Looked also at the procedures that the researchers used to search for respondents, because again, this is more about the research process than about the respondents themselves, and looked at the numbers of contact attempts that were needed to successfully locate respondents. Some of the measures that we used a psychiatric distress measure, the Global Severity Index, which is a previous week measure of psychiatric distress, and that comes from brief symptom inventory questions which were embedded in the survey. Our measure of substance dependence operationalized the DSM-IV definition of substance dependence. The problem drinking variable was 2 of 3, consumption frequency, amount, consequences for alcohol dependence and then symptoms. Weekly plus drug use used all illegal drugs, unprescribed prescriptions, and cannabis. And the substance abuse measure, which was in the WCLS, was a measure that used problem drinking or weekly drug use, and this is the one that I've actually used in this particular presentation. So how did we identify hard-to-reach respondents? Well, the data were not collected really as part of a nutrition analysis, so when I asked for the coder's field notes, I got about 7,000 pages of notes that the trackers used as they looked for people. And we coded and quantified those. So we came up with a definition of hard to reach that was taken really from survey research and public health literature, and also from interviews that we did with survey researchers in survey research centers around the country. And what we settled on was more than 14 phone calls or 5 letters, or more than 3 residential visits, 1 or more non-residential visits. These are unusual places like soup kitchens and jails and parks and check cashing places and the corner that they might be found on. Or if the search was open for more than 60 days, or if the fieldwork agency gave up and gave the file back to the staff. In the full sample, WCLS achieved a response rate, these are all weighted now, of 89%. Without the hard-to-reach respondents, we estimate we would have had a 71% response rate. Now, I want to look at the achieved response rate for a minute. In pink, you have significant differences between that 89% and subgroups. And the substance-dependent group was somewhat less likely to be found, but we still had an 80% response rate. With co-occurring psychiatric distress, that was pretty low. We still only achieved a 73% response rate, even with extended tracking. And again, substance abuse with co-occurring psychiatric distress, somewhat less likely to be found. If we go over to the response rate, excluding hard to reach, we have a difference of about 20% in most categories, except substance dependence, a little more than that. But what I want to point out is that the response rate, excluding hard to reach, started out at 53% for substance dependence and co-occurring psychiatric distress, and we only got that up to 73%. So looking at who was hard to reach among substance users, in the full sample, 18% of our sample was hard to reach. And in substance dependence, it was 25%. Everyone else was between 18 and 21%. And none of these were statistically significant, but we actually weren't really concerned with that as much as we were concerned with the actual results that we had and what that meant for our follow-up. The substance dependent and substance abuse groups were somewhat likely to provide their own phone numbers at baseline. Co-occurring psychiatric distress even less likely to provide their own phone numbers, but all groups were equally likely to provide phone numbers for at least one contact person. The substance dependence and substance abuse groups with co-occurring psychiatric distress were possibly more likely to provide a phone number for 2 or more contacts, but that wasn't significant. And almost nobody didn't give us a phone number, so only 16 people did not provide some phone number for us or some contact information. We did a brief 6-month check-in. Everyone was equally likely to have been contacted for that. That wasn't an intensive effort, though. The substance-dependent group was more likely to receive at least one residential or non-residential visit than the other respondents. So 44% of our substance-dependent group required at least one visit to their home or the home of a contact person, and 17%, I was actually surprised to see that, required a visit to the local park, to the jail, to a check cashing store to find them. And in our full sample, 31% got a residential visit, and 8% got a non-residential visit. At the 12-month follow-up, the substance-dependent group was more likely than other respondents to have been interviewed in the field. That is, rather than by telephone, they may have been contacted by phone and requested an interview in the field, or they may have just been found in the field. So what did it take to find the respondents? Actually, there's very little difference among the groups. The telephone calls, the the full group required a median of 3, a mean of 5, and you can see the ranges here. The range is larger for the full group in all studies, but the full group is larger, so that makes sense. There wasn't very much difference, and what difference there was, it took less effort, actually, to find the substance-dependent and substance-abuse groups, if you looked at the whole sample, not just the hard-to-reach. And there was really no difference in the number of visits or the number of non-residential visits if you looked at the mean and median. So we found that substance dependence respondents were less likely to provide their own telephone number and more likely to receive in-person visits and more likely to be interviewed in the field. And this could be because substance dependence is related to cumulative disadvantage in an already marginalized welfare population in a very wealthy county, and could also contribute to lack of stability. It also can contribute to the propensity for not being found. The other thing, though, that was interesting is these data were collected in 2001 at baseline, and people didn't have mobile phones as much as they do now. And they didn't have pagers as much as they do now. They were, if you remember, they were expensive and hard to get, and you needed a credit check. So actually, I'm very curious to know whether or not having this mobile technology that so many people have would make a difference in this. We found that including hard-to-reach respondents substantially increased our response rates, and we speculated that this possibly reduced attrition bias, actually did an analysis of that, which I will be presenting later on, and in some cases it actually did reduce attrition bias. So we found the most differences in the substance-dependent subgroup, but the differences were not very large, were not that substantial, except in a few cases. The substance-dependent users with co-occurring psychiatric distress were substantially harder to find and harder to bring the response rate up. The in-person interviews were most common among substance-dependent respondents, but most studies don't do community tracking, particularly studies of general population. They don't do that. The big surveys mostly don't do in-person. Study NHIS is different, but most of them don't. And so these other studies may be risking higher attrition rates, and we felt that the extended effort increased response rate and was well worth the added time and money, and there was a lot of added time and money. Some of the limitations is our sample and study population. Our sample contained large numbers of respondents who were considered to be hard to reach, so we were able to really look at that. But our data come from 8 recipients in 1 California county, which makes generalizing these results difficult. At least it has to be done with caution. And we think future research needs to be done with other populations and general population studies. Our co-occurring substance abuse and mental health problems variable was not ideal because it was a 1-week measure of psychiatric distress and the week before people were coming down to apply for welfare for the first time. So this may not actually represent their normal state of mind. And it was combined with a 1-year measure of problematic substance use. We used baseline substance use, baseline survey data with participation status at a 12-month follow-up because we wanted to look at the lost respondents as well as the found respondents. But the use status may change over time. It did allow us to examine at baseline whether or not we could predict who might be hard to find at follow-up, and actually there wasn't that much difference. I'd like to acknowledge Laura Schmidt, who is the principal investigator of WCLS and a faculty member at the Institute for Health Policy Studies. A number of people from Berkeley were on my dissertation committee, which is when I started this research, and the WCLS study team and the alcohol research group where this study is housed. And of course, to the funders who funded WCLS and also my research.